You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the newsroom to you live.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Election 2024, the Post Political Roundtable. I'm Sean Sullivan, the campaign editor here at the Washington Post, and today we continue our discussion of the 2024 presidential race with some of the top journalists in our newsroom who are out covering this race on the trail. I actually want to begin today on a slightly different note with a political trivia question that I'm going to have for our two reporters in the next segment. That question is this: who announced his presidential candidacy 56 years ago this week? So it's going to go way back in history. And I'll have the answer to that question later on in the program. But first, I want to welcome Isaac Arnsdorf, national political reporter here at the Post, back to the program. Isaac, welcome back to Election 2024.
I've been instructed not to guess, but I think I know the answer.
Okay. So, Isaac, I want to start with where we are in the presidential campaign. You've covered Donald Trump's campaign from the start. We're now at a phase where President Biden and former President Trump have both clinched the number of delegates needed to be their party's nominees. There is no drama left in the competitive primary phase of this campaign. So where are we in this race? How were they able to clinch that officially this week? And where are we now? And what are you looking for going forward between these two rivals?
So what we mean that they've clinched the nominations, and we're now using the language presumptive nominee. What that means is that they both have won in the states that have voted in their primaries and caucuses so far. Both Trump and Biden have won enough pledged delegates to win a majority on the first ballot at the Republican and Democratic National Conventions that will happen later this summer. So they don't officially become the nominees until this summer, but we know based on the primaries already, they have enough delegates. Unless something crazy happens, they will be the nominees. And, you know, how did they do that? You know, that's kind of the mathematical answer to your question. But more conceptually, they were both running. I mean, Biden is literally running as an incumbent. And there are certainly a lot of Democrats out of there who would love to jump in if he were to pass the torch to the next generation. But given that he didn't do that, the trivia question is related to this: why, you know, you don't jump in and challenge a sitting president from the same party, as opposed to on the Republican side, you know, Trump was not literally an incumbent, but, you know, functionally he kind of operated that way. And his campaign certainly tried everything they could do to use the leverage as if he were an incumbent, being the former president, being the most popular figure in the party, pressuring lawmakers to line up behind him, kind of using all the advantages of incumbency that he had from having been president, and riding that to a large extent all the way through to the end.
Yeah, okay. So let's talk a little bit about the strategies. And you and your colleagues had a great piece recently about the Trump campaign strategy to improve his standing among Black voters. Can you talk about what they're doing and how is this being received right now?
Yeah, so this got a lot of attention because a few weeks ago, Trump was speaking to an event that was called the Black Conservatives Gala in South Carolina. And what he said there was basically that that Black voters liked him because he had a mugshot. Because he has a brush with the criminal justice system now, and his words were that because of how he feels like he's being persecuted by the legal system, that was something that a lot of Black Americans could relate to. Now, to be clear, that line went over really well in that room among Black Trump supporters. A lot of people outside of that room found that very offensive for playing on stereotypes. But we did a story and did some reporting that really looked beyond just the way that Trump articulated that. But the campaign is really making a more extensive and sophisticated pitch to Black voters, because there is actually a lot of polling to suggest that Trump has improved among previous Republican nominees, specifically with Black men. And that in a few of the states that are going to decide this election, specifically Georgia, Michigan, Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, where there are large Black populations in the cities, the Democrats really, really need those votes. And the Trump campaign thinks, you know, they're under no illusion that they're going to win a majority of Black voters or Black men. But if they can improve just a little bit, just a few points, either by having those voters stay home and not turn out for Joe Biden, or even by persuading them to vote for Donald Trump, that could actually be decisive in a very close election.
Yeah, that strategy is going to be really something that we're going to want to watch in the coming months. Okay, so elsewhere in the Republican Party, Isaac, I wanted to ask you about the Republican National Committee. You were recently at an RNC meeting in Houston. We've seen a whole lot of change at the top levels of the RNC. We've seen layoffs at various levels and a lot of restructuring. It seems like a lot of turbulence there right now. Can you talk through sort of what is happening, what you guys have found in your reporting? Why are we seeing all of this change right now happen at this political committee?
So what's going on is effectively a merger between the Trump campaign and the RNC, which the RNC itself, so this is the central committee of the National Republican Party. And as long as there was a primary, it was under some obligation to be neutral. And, you know, there was criticism about how the RNC ran the debates and various things, you know, were they favoring Trump too much or too little? Point is, now that the primary is over, it's pretty normal for the nominee to get their way with the RNC. And what that's really about is about money and staff. And so Trump has basically at his direction replaced the formal elected leadership of the RNC, also the staff operational leadership, and that has included a lot of low-level firings, a lot of layoffs and replacements out in the field throughout the country, which is like a pretty chaotic thing to be doing 8 months out from the election. But what it is about is money. The RNC has had a string of really disappointing fundraising periods. Both Trump and the RNC together are way behind Biden and the DNC in money. And what this allows them to do is, first of all, put a cap on the expenses that are still going out the door. And then because of really complicated campaign finance rules that we don't have to get into, but the bottom line is this merger allows the RNC, which the Democrats have functionally already been doing, this allows the Trump campaign and the RNC to get together and start raising a lot more money in hard dollars in single checks through campaign finance laws. And that's really going to be a focus for them in the coming months to try to close that gap with the Democrats.
Yeah, that's really interesting to watch. Okay, last thing I want to ask you, Isaac, we got a couple minutes left since we're in general election mode officially. Immigration and border security just seem like a hugely central issue to this election right now. And you did a pretty extensively reported story that looks at what Trump and his associates and allies are talking about doing on the border, talking about doing when it comes to immigration in general. What did you find when you reported that?
So, I mean, obviously, we remember, you know, Trump's 2016 campaign, immigration was a central theme, and they're very much bringing that back in this campaign. And, you know, he can always go more, he can always go harder, and has continued to escalate the dehumanizing and demonizing language that he has used to describe undocumented immigrants. And that was even before we've had the record numbers at the border that we've seen in the last few months, which really got the White House's attention and have caused the Biden campaign to lean in this as well. So last week or the week before, you had both of them were at the Texas border on the same day. And there was the showdown over the immigration bill in Congress, which was a bipartisan bill that was negotiated by Republicans. And then Trump came in and imposed and was pretty upfront that the reason was he didn't want to hand Biden a win. And Biden is now using that, as we saw in the State of the Union, to, you know, Trump actually said, blame me. And Biden is taking him up on that and is trying to pin the blame on Trump. And that's going to be, those are the battle lines that are being drawn on this issue that we're going to be hearing about through November.
Yeah, it's going to be a really interesting debate to watch play out between these two sides. Okay, Isaac Arnsdorf, who's going to be on top of this general election now that it's officially here, or unofficially, however you want to word it, the rest of the way. But thank you so much, Isaac, for joining us. Okay, yes. I want to continue the program now with two more of our campaign reporters who are covering the race out on the trail, Colby Itkowitz and Marianne Levine. Welcome to both of you to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, so before we get into the discussion, I want to remind everybody of our political trivia question. Maybe you guys already know the answer. Don't spoil it for now if you do. But who announced their presidential campaign 56 years ago this week? We'll give you a hint. The announcement took place just about a mile from where we are here at 13th and K Street in downtown Washington. So bust out your Google Maps app and figure out where that might have happened. I'll give you guys the answer at the end of this chat. Okay, so Colby, we're in general election mode. I was just talking to Isaac about that. The Biden-Trump matchup is in full swing here. One variable seems to be the question of where Nikki Haley's supporters go to. She just ended her campaign. Are there any early indications of where those voters are headed and what both the Biden campaign and Trump campaigns are doing or not doing to try to convince those supporters to back them?
Yeah, Sean, this has been on my mind since I was up in New Hampshire with you all, attending Nikki Haley events and talking to voters there. And what I found when I was talking to Nikki Haley voters was a lot of people that just didn't think they could stomach voting for Trump. Either they didn't in 2020, they had supported Biden, or maybe they did, but after January 6th or after the Roe getting overturned, there's a number of issues that have occurred since the 2020 election that has really made them sour on Trump. And so, you know, polls are showing us conflicting things. There's a lot of people that believe that Republican voters ultimately come home, that they will, if they are Republicans, that they will eventually kind of not be able to bring themselves to vote for Biden and will vote for Trump. But I think you're also going to find a lot of never Trumpers among Nikki Haley's supporters and people that might feel that for the good of democracy, for the good of women's rights and other such freedoms, to kind of eliminate the chance of chaos, which is what Nikki Haley said we would have if we had four more years of Trump, that they might just go and vote for Biden.
So when Haley ended her campaign, she sent a pretty stark message. She said that Trump needed to earn the support of her voters. Have we seen anything from the Trump campaign or from the former president himself that suggests that he's trying to do that right now?
Well, so on Super Tuesday, he was out on his Truth Social and said, you know, right away that he had trounced Nikki Haley in those races. And then I wrote it down here. He invited Nikki Haley supporters to join the greatest movement in the history of our nation. But before that, you know, he had not done a lot of overtures to Haley voters. In fact, he at one point had said that if anyone had donated to Nikki Haley's campaign, that they were barred from the MAGA camp forever. And so it would take a lot, I think, for Trump to convince some of these voters that he wants to bring them into the fray or that he wants to open up the tent to include them. And so far, in true Trump fashion, he has not done much to reach out to those voters.
Interesting. Okay. So a lot of Haley's approach was based on appealing to independent voters, voters who are not affiliated with a political party. We actually have a viewer question on this very topic, which I want to read. Dave Terrell from Illinois asks, what do you consider the most compelling argument to independents for re-electing President Biden? So, Marianne, I want to ask you, what are you seeing in your reporting that would suggest what the Biden campaign is doing or isn't doing to try to appeal to independent voters right now in this election?
Well, I think the Biden campaign is really betting on the fact that independent voters will not want the chaos of the Trump administration. I think what the Biden campaign has been really focused on recently is trying to remind people of what Trump was like as president. And I think they're making a bet here that once people are reminded of what he was like, they'll eventually come home and vote for Biden. And so we'll see if that pays off. But I think they're also very much leaning into the abortion message. I think there's a bet there that that message will resonate also among independent voters who did not want to see Roe v. Wade overturned.
Interesting. And Marianne, I want to ask you about former President Trump, who you cover very closely. Now he's talking about picking a running mate, which is a decision that a lot of people will be watching closely. What are you seeing? What are you hearing in your reporting about where that stands right now?
Well, right now, it doesn't seem like picking a running mate is at the forefront of the focus of the Trump campaign. They've been pretty focused on the RNC going in there and essentially changing leadership there, changing shop there. So I think that that's where the campaign's immediate focus is. But that obviously hasn't stopped Trump from being the source of a lot of the speculation around who he would potentially pick as a vice presidential candidate. Right now, we're not expecting him to make a decision anytime soon. I think we likely think he'll make a decision closer to the convention, but we're certainly seeing people audition for it, even if they're trying to do so subtly or not so subtly in some cases. And he's rattled off lists of names. He's mentioned Tim Scott. He's mentioned Kristi Noem. He's mentioned other people who have, I think Ron DeSantis was once mentioned at one point. So, and there's a lot of names that are out there right now. And I think we can expect this process to kind of drag out until probably early summer.
Yeah, I remember when the DeSantis thing came up, I think there were a lot of raised eyebrows given the things that those two men said about each other over the last year as they competed in this race. Colby, I wanted to ask you sort of a bigger picture question, which is, we've seen some polling about Republicans and where they stand with Trump, Democrats, where they stand with Biden, and some indication at least that Trump has consolidated or coalesced the party behind him more than Biden has among Democrats. We've seen, in fact, you've reported on a lot of this. We've seen a lot of dissatisfaction in the party with Biden about his handling of the war in the Middle East. So I guess my question is, who is sort of in more control of their party right now? Who has the party behind them more solidly? Is it Trump or is it Biden, and who has more work to do?
It's really interesting, Sean, because if you're talking about voters, it is true that there are a lot of Democrats, particularly younger voters, voters of color, who are disappointed in President Biden, specifically around the war in Gaza. They feel like it's been mishandled, and they want the president to come out stronger in calling for a ceasefire there. But if you're talking about like the official party, it's pretty incredible to see how the party apparatus itself has coalesced around Biden. You even had Ilhan Omar come out this week and say that she absolutely supports people voting for Biden. You have AOC saying the same. Bernie Sanders is a surrogate for President Biden. People that you think may have maybe distanced themselves from the president, especially over this current issue in Gaza, are still saying that the best thing for this country is to vote for President Biden again. And so he really does have the entire Democratic Party, the establishment, the elected officials rallied behind him, ready to work to get him reelected in the fall. The question is, are they going to be able to convince those disenchanted voters, the base voters, a lot of them are base Democratic voters, to come out, or those younger voters, or those voters of color, maybe they won't vote for President Trump, but they might sit it out. And I think that's the thing that the Biden camp is most afraid of, is that they're not going to be able to convince those core voters to show up in November.
Yeah, that's a really big question. Do they stay home? Do they vote for a third party candidate? Do they eventually get back into his fold? I think if the race is really close in some of these key swing states, that could be a really big factor. Marianne, I wanted to point out a great story that you had recently that looked at some Trump speeches, the things that he is saying at these rallies that he is holding, and the kind of window and glimpse they give us into what a potential second term would look like, things he's saying he would do, like pardoning those convicted in connection with the January 6th attack at the Capitol. You've been to a lot of these Trump rallies, you've covered them on site closely, so you're there in the atmosphere. How does this kind of stuff come across with supporters in those rallies when he talks about this stuff?
I think his message is pretty popular among his base of supporters. Whether that message translates in a general election is a broader question, but I think that oftentimes at his rallies, he'll say he'll have his laugh lines. He'll have his go-to lines. He'll tell stories about foreign leaders, like we wrote about in our story about how he often tells a story about a conversation he had with Macron, and he like starts to imitate Macron's French accent, and a lot of the people in the crowd find that funny. And so I think his message is pretty. I mean, the response to his message is very strong at his events. I was at his rally in Rome, Georgia, on Saturday, and he basically had the attention of everyone in the crowd. It was a pretty, it was a pretty intense reaction that he was able to elicit from people, an intense reaction of support. And so I think the messages with his base play very well. I think we have yet to see how this will play out among swing voters in Wisconsin and Michigan and all the swing states we'll be watching. But I think that a lot of how he portrays the country, a lot of how he talks about election denialism, a lot of the main attributes of his speeches tend to resonate with the people going to his rallies.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So Colby, I want to ask you sort of the flip side to that question, which is, you know, it seems like a word that comes up a lot with voters who don't like Donald Trump, or maybe some even who are on the fence, is fear about what would happen in a second Trump term. So can you talk a little bit about how Democrats and how the Biden campaign is reacting to that? And, you know, are there certain tactics or strategies they are using or they are putting forward to suggest to voters that they should be fearful of a second Trump term?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can just look at President Biden's State of the Union address last week and the way that it was basically a kickoff political speech for the general election campaign. He referenced his predecessor a number of times, not by name, but he would say my predecessor. And he talked about things like January 6th. He talked about threats to democracy. He talked about threats to reproductive rights. He mentioned the Alabama ruling around IVF. So I think that there are two kind of tracks of messages. There's a policy message, and then there's also just kind of this idea that when President Trump was in office, there was constant chaos, and you never knew day to day kind of what headline was going to pop up on your phone, something President Trump had tweeted or something that he had done, and an idea that he had had that, you know, we got wind of. And so it's been relatively calm and normal in Washington for these last couple of years. And so they're really going to have to sell the American people on one, there's some policy things to really be afraid of. And then there's also this idea that he's just going to sow chaos in our federal government and internationally in our geopolitics. He's, you know, wants to be friends with Vladimir Putin and other kind of dictators and authoritarians around the world. And so what does that look like for the future of America's democracy? And that's what Democrats will be telling voters over these next couple of months.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Marianne, I want to talk to you about the economy, which is something that both Trump and Biden seem to be talking about a lot. We've seen some data that shows inflation ticking back up. We've heard from Biden, who has often said, look, the economy is getting better. Here are some indicators. Open question of whether, you know, people feel that or not. But how do you see the economy factoring into this election? What do you hear from voters when you talk to them about how this factors into their vote?
Yeah, I think the economy, like in every election, is a pretty big priority for people. I think one of the challenges that the Biden campaign has is that even though there are a lot of very positive metrics about the economy, there's pretty strong job growth right now, unemployment is low, they're still dealing with at least a perception that the economy isn't working for a lot of voters. And so in conversations with people, with voters both in Wisconsin and also at in Georgia over the weekend, a lot of the times people point to just how expensive groceries still are and how they still feel like they're paying more at the grocery store or more for gas. And I think that the effect of inflation is still something that people are feeling, even if we have all these other metrics that indicate that the economy is strong in a lot of other areas. So I think the question is, how does the Biden campaign kind of overcome that? How do they overcome concerns about inflation? And how does the Trump campaign capitalize on the economy right now and the inflation numbers and try to get people to come to them?
Yeah, and Colby, I want to go back to immigration, which is another issue in addition to the economy that seems to be a big one on people's minds. We talked with Isaac in the last segment about some of the strategies on both sides. But I want to ask you, does the fact that Congress hasn't acted on immigration hasn't enacted an immigration overhaul or a border security overhaul? Is that something that could work in President Biden's favor? Is that something that works against him? How are you seeing that in your reporting right now?
Yeah, President Biden certainly hopes that he can sell the message to voters that Trump kind of quashed the chances of a bipartisan border bill that was working its way through Congress. It's a little bit wonky, and so I don't know how many voters are tuned into that, the mechanics of what goes on Capitol Hill, but there was a bill in the works, and President Trump kind of urged Republicans to block it, and so they did. And so what President Biden's gonna say, he's already been saying it, he said it down at the border when he took his trip there, is like, come on, Republicans, I'm ready to do something, I'm ready to secure the border, come work with me. He even offered an olive branch to President Trump and said, Trump, come on, like, let's work together, let's fix the border, which irked some Democrats. But so if people are paying attention to kind of the turns of the screws of how things go in Washington, the Biden campaign is hoping they can convince those voters that, look, we're the ones that want to get something done. And it's Trump who's an obstructionist. It's Trump who's making it harder to secure the border.
Interesting. Okay, I want to ask something to both of you, since you were out on the trail a lot for us over the last year, through snowy, winding drives through Iowa and long nights in New Hampshire and in South Carolina. Is there something that you saw on the trail over the last few months that was an indicator that potentially bodes well for one candidate or the other, something that you saw that was, you know, a positive indicator for Biden or a positive indicator for Trump, or maybe for neither right now? Maybe something about an appetite for third party candidates. Anyway, you guys saw a lot more than a lot of people over the last few months. So, Marianne, I want to start with you. What stands out?
Yeah, I think it just the lack of enthusiasm broadly about the choices people have right now. I think when you step outside of a Trump event or you step outside of a Biden event, there are not a lot of voters who are excited about their choices. I think one thing that we have run into, all of us on the trail have run into, is that people have a hard time believing that we are truly going to a 2020 rematch. And so just the lack of enthusiasm about the two options on the table is something that has always struck me. And also the concerns that people have about one thing that struck me when I was in Milwaukee last year, last October, was just how often Democratic-leaning voters brought up aid to Ukraine and foreign aid. And I think that's something that stood out to me in a way, because this is something that the Democratic Party has been pushing for very heavily, along with Republicans in the Senate. But that was one theme that stuck out to me, and I'm curious if that's going to be a theme that is going to continue as we head closer to the general election. But I think the lack of enthusiasm and the disbelief that this is the election and these are the two choices people have right now, I think that's really stuck out to me.
What about you, Colby?
Yeah, I was going to say something quite similar, which is just that, you know, you talk to voters and they wish they had another choice. They wish that they didn't have to choose between Biden and Trump again this year. And so whether that means they're going to lean towards Trump or lean towards Biden, in a lot of the cases, you know, some of those more moderate centrist swing voters, the ones that are going to decide this election in states like Pennsylvania, are just kind of frustrated. I spend a lot of time in the suburbs of some of these swing states, particularly in the suburban areas around Philadelphia and Pennsylvania. And, you know, you talk to voters there and there's just this level of frustration. Like, they don't want Trump to be president again, but they also really don't want to vote for Biden. And they wish that there were other choices, whether it's other Democrats had challenged Biden or whether there was a strong third party option. But at the end of the day, these are the choices they have. And so it remains to be seen how those swing voters actually end up voting in November.
Yeah, that'll be a big question. Okay, it is trivia time again. Very exciting. Do either of you want to venture a guess at the answer to our trivia question, which I will remind everybody is, who announced their presidential campaign 56 years ago this week? Who wants to take a shot at that?
Once I did the math in my head, I think I know.
Okay, go for it.
All right. Was it, drum roll,
I wish we got to get a drum roll going here.
Was it Bobby Kennedy?
It was. Very, very
awesome,
impressive work. He announced on March 16th, 1968, at the Russell Senate Office Building, where his brother, had announced his candidacy exactly 8 years earlier. Let's take a listen to his announcement.
I am announcing today my candidacy for the presidency of the United States. I do not run for the presidency merely to oppose any man, but to propose new policies. I run because I am convinced that this country is on a perilous course, and because I have such strong feelings about what must be done, and I feel that I'm obliged to do all that I can.
56 years ago. Colby, you're the winner today. If I had a prize of some sort, I would give it to you right now.
But, I'm struck.
But that was
by
very impressive.
I was struck by how much he looks like his son, or his son looks like him, rather.
I was thinking the same thing. You can see the resemblance.
In the eye. Yeah.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, but thank you both, Marianne Levine, Colby Itquitz. Thank you for being on the program, and we hope to have you back on soon.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening. For more information on our upcoming programs, go to WashingtonPostLive.com.